Good afternoon, and welcome to State Departments and Veterans Budget Division for Tuesday, March 4th. It's about 5 minutes after 3. Quorum is present. Members, today we're going to have 6 reviews. State auditor's with us. We look forward to hearing from her, the Department of Veterans Affairs, along with Minnesota Management and Budget, the Department of Military Affairs, and then we'll have the Department of Administration review and the Capital Restoration update. So the scopes of these reviews are same as last Thursday. We'll have testifiers come up, give a brief update on the first year's expenditures from the budget just passed last year, how they're going coming into the second year, and if they have any unsession items that they may have or any items they feel division should hear. With that, we're going to start with the State Auditor. Madam Auditor, please come forward and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rebecca Otto, the State Auditor. Pleased to be with you, and we will keep it brief. So Mitch gave me some specific items to cover today, and one of them being, and you have a handout, I believe, he was hoping for us to provide a list of the costs broken up by salaries and expenditures for our audit practice division, and that will be a handout that looks a little bit like this. It's got revenues and expenditures, okay? So, and it's pretty self-explanatory, all right? And it has some hourly rates on there as well for the different classes of our auditors. Okay, next, a schedule of hourly rates, which we provided to MMB and to the committee. And on your handout, I think you've got it on your handout. So there's a letter on one side of your handout. On the other side, there's a schedule with the different level of auditors that we have and the hourly rates from 13, and then it shows the hourly rates for 14. And annually we have to calculate our audit rates because statute requires us to recover our costs when we audit, and so we go through a process with MMB and they have to approve the audit rates. One of the requests that Mitch had given me was kind of talk about the change in the audit rates, and they reflect the state contracts. So the increase that went to state employees is reflected in our rates, as we're required to do. So,
any questions for the auditor? Okay, go ahead.
Okay. And I was asked to report on the number of FTEs in the audit division at the beginning of the biennium versus today. We went from, in the audit division, 72 FTEs to 69 right now. Basically, the difference is that we have a few less interns during this time of the year. We'll have a few more in the summertime. So the numbers at the beginning were more summer when we had more interns, and now this reflects the fact that we have less interns. And then I think I'm down to, oh, my gosh, am I already done with all that? Oh, no, I know. The enterprise fund for the audit division. So we have not prepared our financial statements for our enterprise fund. That'll be in a couple of months. But what I can report to you today is that our receipts to date are about $2.9 million. Our billed receivables are about $864,000. We have some unbilled receivables, and they're about $1 million. The disbursements that we've made, so that's going to be about $4.9 million in terms of receipts and billed receivables and unbilled receivables. And then our disbursements are about $3.9 million. We have some salaries payable right now of about $292,000. But because we haven't prepared our financial statements yet, we don't have factored in, like, long-term liabilities and things like that. So we'll have that information at the end of the fiscal year for you all for the next budget cycle. So it looks like we may have a net right now, but that doesn't factor in, again, those long-term liabilities. But it seems that the enterprise fund is functioning as intended and hoped. And then finally, if there are no questions on that, I was going to give you a brief update on the brilliant legislation that you carried last year, Senator Saxhog, on the CTAS, the finance software for our towns and small cities. I'm really happy to report that that is working as intended, too. The state created a special revenue fund from that legislation for us to collect user fees from the towns and small cities that use our financial software that's very specialized for them. It's a great product for them. And they paid a $300 fee, And we thought $300,000 at minimum to engage with a vendor. Well, the good news is we have to date collected $312,000 in fees, so we have enough. We've engaged with a vendor, and we've encumbered about $298,000 for that contract. So the good news is we're going to have fees left over to do the maintenance, the ongoing maintenance, which we were hoping for. So this is working out very, very well. And we had a working group of towns and small cities who wanted to participate in figuring out the changes we wanted on the program besides updating the platform, all the wish list items. We had then a volunteer group of towns, and I think there might have been a small city, that helped us interview the vendors and select the vendor. And now we have a group of about 20 towns and small cities that are going to be user testers. So as the software is developed, they'll be doing testing, and we'll look for bugs and make sure we come out with the best product possible for them. So it's been embraced. It's moving along very well, and we're really, really happy that it's worked out the way it has.
Madam Auditor, you said that you collected $312,000, and that's $300 a piece. Is there what percentage do you think of the cities and townships that are eligible or want to use that are participating?
So I think we had about 1,700 users, or was it 1,600 approximately?
1,300 users.
1,300 users prior, and we now have over 1,000 that have done a pre-order, which, you know, they pay the fee. And I understand from the Association of Townships, we have towns that have never used it before that have now paid the fee that want to use it. There's a lot of excitement around the program, so, you know, it'd be great if we had 100%. And what's been reported to me is there's a whole bunch of towns that are waiting to pay the fee once the software is actually available. But the community worked really hard with each other to convince all, you know, they were like, we got to do this, we need this software, because the other options are more expensive, they're more product than they need, and they don't necessarily want to have to learn all new software. And they get support with this, they get a user manual. So participation has been phenomenal.
And so what's about the limit? I mean, for a community before this makes sense. I mean, obviously, Minneapolis doesn't use it.
No.
Okay, so at what point do you... does it appear that this becomes...
Where it's a usable product?
Yeah.
Yeah, the small towns, it's perfect. Really small cities, cash cities, it works very well. If they have enterprise funds, it gets a little bit more complicated for them. The Gap cities and Gap towns typically won't use it, although I think we have one. Gap is an accounting... it's technical. Anyway, but they tend to have... need more than what the product provides. But we have a lot of small towns and small cities in Minnesota. So I think this product is the envy of other states, too, because, frankly, it's a really good idea, and we tend to be better in government and have smart programs. And so this allows them to use the software that we're comfortable with as an office. And then we're building in some things that will make it easier for them to report to us through that system, which is, again, a really good thing, because the less you handle data, the more integrity it's usually going to have. What's interesting for us that we've run into is we've had CPA firms who want to come in for our trainings and want software, and because they work with some of these local entities. And so we had to figure out the licensing based on the language we got in statute, but we think we've figured something out generally, right? I don't think we need special legislation. We're going to be able to work it out. But it's being embraced, and so we're all really excited about the upgrade.
Yeah, happy to hear that.
Chairman?
Question, yeah, Senator Benson.
Madam Auditor, you mentioned you collected $1 million in unbillable. What would that mean, or what?
Oh.
What? Is there examples of something in that category? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, sorry, it's been a little while. So when I mentioned unbilled receivables, so we've done work, our auditors have been engaged in doing audits, but we haven't billed for it yet. You know, we bill periodically. So, Matt tried to pull together some numbers of where we put the hours in, but we haven't actually billed them. So he did an estimate on what we think that was, just to give you an idea of where we are, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess I might have been just a little confused.
Okay.
That hasn't happened before with me, but all right, I get it. Thank you.
Senator, yes. Any other questions? Okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Madam Auditor.
Am I done?
Yes.
I don't know. Are you done?
Get up.
I'm done.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Other questions?
Yes.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good
luck with the session.
Thanks for coming. Thank you.
Next we have the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs Review. Mike McKinney. Mr. Director, how are you?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Mike McKelney from Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs.
Go ahead. We're waiting.
All right, Mr. Chair. What you should have received is just a brief overview of some of the appropriations we received last year. And I will tell you, as we go through here talking about the Honor Guards, the GI Bill, what we've listed is just an annual appropriation, not what we received for the biennium. So I hope to make that clear. So just starting from the top.
But Mr. Director, as you go down these, I mean, realizing that you don't necessarily have to have the budget in mind, but tell us if you think they're successful or they're proceeding the way you think they should be.
Certainly.
Okay.
So the Honor Guard funding, as you recall, we received quite a bit of outcry to ensure that the funding was there for the veterans. For the year, first half of the biennium, that's $200,000. We've expended $77,150 to date, leaving a balance of $122,850. And we're right on track with that, we believe, moving through the year. So we think that that appropriation of $400,000 was right on track. The Minnesota GI Bill and OJT and apprenticeship, we received a $400,000 appropriation, $200,000. For the year, 100,000 of that is actually transferred to MNSCU for an FTE position there. And we've expended 11,286 for the OJT and apprenticeship portion, and we're sitting with a balance of $88,714. And that one kind of ebbs and flows. It just depends what the job market has out there as to how many people might go into the skills and trades to use this. So we're just watching that one pretty closely right now, Mr. Chair. The Gold Star funding program, as you recall, that was transferred some years back from military affairs to Veterans Affairs. We held our annual conference back in October, I believe. The appropriation limit for that for a year is $100,000. We expended $43,105, and I believe this $56,000 balance is just extra at this point. So we were able to get a good deal with the venue for this year, and so we're going to continue to try to get the best deal possible. But I can't tell you if this is too much or too little at this point in time. The County Veteran Service Officers, as you recall, they received $2.2 million for the biennium, $1.1 million for each year to supplement their operations. Attached with this is a spreadsheet that we supplied that shows the actual counties and amounts, again, as a reminder to the committee of how that distribution was to work based on veteran population in those counties. And to date, I believe 78 counties or 79 counties have received the grants. There's still 8 counties out there that have not submitted their documentation to receive the grant at this point. So that's being spent right as calculated.
And are you, Mr. Richter, are you getting good feedback in that this is enough or not enough? For what kind of feedback do you get from the different county terms of?
Well, Mr. Chair, what I can tell you, we haven't had any negative feedback at this point. And so there's a CVSO conference going on as we speak, and our senior director is there, and I imagine he'll come back with quite a bit of feedback relative to these funds. But nothing is significant to report at this point.
Okay, great.
Right. Next item on the list, Mr. Chair, is the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, MACV. There was an additional $250,000 appropriation to their annual appropriations last year, and giving them $1.5 million for the biennium. Out of that, $750,000 for 2014, $444,845 have been spent, leaving them a remainder of $305,155. And we believe that's right on cue as well. The Veteran Paramedic Apprenticeship Program, as you recall, we turned in $110,000 for that program. Criteria from way back, I don't think everything was met or whatever the case was. I don't remember the history exactly, Mr. Chair, but there's some funds remaining in the accounts that we turned back into the general fund. Next item you'll see on here is the IT improvements. As you recall, we received $5 million one-time appropriation for the biennium with some tails. And that was to initially address five major problem areas: security, compliance, efficient and effective IT management, service recoverability and risk management, continuous process improvement, and system availability. And listed within those topics are a little bit more specifics, but what I'll do is just jump to where we're at to date, Mr. Chair. And as far as the security compliance goes, security standards and HIPAA assessment has been complete, so we're making progress there. The efficient and effective IT service management piece, where a third-party assessment was to be conducted, is complete. Service metrics between the agency and Minute have been defined. Service recoverability and risk management, SharePoint implementation is in progress over at the agency. The continuous process improvement, which is a release management process developed, incident workstation management process, management and service request tools were implemented. Purchase processes were implemented. Workstation management process improvements and development have all been done and are well underway, so we're making some progress. And then the last bullet comment there, system availability, the infrastructure cleanup is well underway. The desktop upgrades at all the locations are in progress and I think just about mostly complete. At this point, I'm not exactly certain what the timeline is on that. So, in short, in total, roughly $3.1 million was appropriated for the project in fiscal year 2014. They have about $1.9 million remaining for 15. Roughly $1.2 million of that amount was a one-time expenditure for project funds, and $1.9 million is operational funding. And roughly $1.1 million has been encumbered to date, some in the project arena and some in the operational arena.
Question, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McElhinney, you mentioned that $100,000 was transferred for the Department of Higher Education for an FTE position. Is that a one-time appropriation there, or will that position come under your jurisdiction as far as asking for further funding for the next biennium, or will it be the higher education's prerogative to ask for that money?
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, that's an ongoing agreement we have with MNSCU. That there's an FTE and that it's been there for, I think, since about the time the GI Bill came into statute, that they kind of do some work there for us. Really, they help the institutions understand and read DD-214, so when veterans apply for benefits, it's kind of they're a liaison, if you will. So that's been we've had that for quite some time. That's just we're just outlining it in this that part of that money goes to MNSCU.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Harris.
Mr. McElhinney, so what is the title of that person's position?
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, I'd have to actually check to see what her title is. I know who the person is, but I'm not sure what her actual working title is.
Did you get that, Senator Anderson? We'll get that information.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, sir. Why are these eight counties dragging their feet on the MDVA grants? I notice my home county, Dakota County, is not put in their grant yet. What are their deadlines, and are you notifying them that they should get going, or how's that work?
Mr. Chair, and again, Senator, there are deadlines for when the money would need to be spent. And again, there's a conference happening right now where our senior director's at, and this is one of the items that he's addressing is to alert. And we do alert the counties that, you need to take advantage of this very quickly. So we're on them, Senator.
Senator Metz.
Looks like about 22,500 just in Dakota County, and they better
better get their act together. Right. One more quick question.
Senator Metz.
Years ago, we'd give a stipend for grave markers. Do we still do that?
Mr. McElhinney.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the
is that under the funeral thing, or don't you, or do you know?
The Bronze Star markers, which you're referring to, are not included in this appropriationism.
Why did we, Mr. Chairman, members, why did we, I always supported that, and I thought that's a small stipend to pay for our people that served. I know it was only like $40 or $50 a funeral or a. But anyway, well, I guess we'll have to talk about that again. But we did that for years. And I know when we got the budget crunch, Mr. Chairman, we took it away. And
yeah.
Not that we're that wealthy today, but I don't think it was ever a huge amount of money. And maybe you could calculate how many are out, you know, what it would cost. I know more of our WW2 people are dying. I don't know what, 2,000 a day or so, not nationwide. But maybe you could calculate that for this committee or the chairman and myself. I'd like to know what. That would cost the taxpayers if we. It was $25 or $50 toward a grave marker. So,
Mr. McElhinney, do a little research on that.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of an important thing we did when I started here in 1922. Just kidding. I just tried to light.
No, that was when he was born.
Right. No, not even that old. But look into that if you'd be so kind.
We certainly will.
All right, thank you. Other questions? Yeah, Senator Gonzales.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Along those lines, so the ones that that you've not received the applications to date, are they being notified so that they don't miss the opportunity, or what is happening there?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gonzales, yes. I can't tell you the exact date and time that we notified them. I know there's been messaging that's gone out to the CVSOs. We stay in contact with the CVSO president as well as their legislative director, and they are both well aware that those counties are a little bit behind the power curve, and they address that with them, as we're told, fairly often.
All right. Thank you.
Other questions?
That's a lot of money.
One. If not, do you have some more, or is that it? Yeah, that was...
Mr. Chair,
that's quite adequate. Yeah.
That's just about it, Senator. Mr. Chair, there's something else that we can answer.
Well, I appreciate you being here, Mr. McElhinney, and we've got a couple of things, you know, that you're going to get back to us on, and we appreciate that. And thanks for your report.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to have the MMB, Minnesota Management and Budget Review. Welcome, everybody. Would you identify yourself and proceed?
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Michelle Weber, and I'm the Director of Budget Operations. I'll be providing to you an overview of the $4.5 million appropriation that was made for the replacement of two of the budget systems that are used in the budget division, as well as continued development of the BPAS system, the biennial budget system. The information that's in your packet that I'll be speaking to, it's a copy of a PowerPoint presentation that has two slides on each of the pages, and in the top right-hand corner, it says budget systems. So as I previously mentioned, the legislature appropriated $4.5 million to develop these three systems. Of the $4.5 million, $2.1 million has been allocated to continue the development of the budget planning and analysis system, which went live in 2011 and was used for the most recent biennial budget submission to the legislature. $1 million is being used to replace the existing fiscal note tracking system that is used by the legislature and agencies to produce fiscal notes related to legislation that's being considered. And then the remaining $1.4 million is being used to replace the capital budget system. Moving on to page 2, the oversight structure that we have for this involves both agencies and legislative staff. If we look at the top slide on the bottom of page 2, legislative staff are involved in the project teams for each of the three systems, as well as agency staff with MMB staff. And those are more responsible for the day-to-day management, developing the requirements for all of the system, doing testing on the systems to make sure that they're reporting, and prioritizing what functionality we make available. We also have a steering committee that meets on a monthly basis to make decisions on the system, and Eric Nauman from the Senate and Bill Marks from the House of Representatives sit on that steering committee. We've engaged stakeholders on through monthly newsletters that are available as one of the handouts. I have a sample one available in your packets, as well as have brought them in to have specific stakeholder events where we're giving them updates on the systems and hearing back from them about the various needs that they may have. With respect to the biennial budget system, the budget planning and analysis system, in phase one, we utilized it for the development of the operating budget for the 14-15 biennial budget. And since that implementation, we conducted focus groups and did user surveys to identify what improvements did we need to make to that system. Over the last several months, we've been working on improvements around performance and reporting, and we are currently utilizing the system to produce the governor's supplemental budget, which you'll be receiving in this week or into next week. We will also be using it to publish information at the end of the legislative session this year on the enacted budget, the action that the legislature takes with respect to the budget. For future development, we are wanting to provide compensation forecasting tools to agencies so that as they're developing their biennial budgets, they have tools to help them project what their staffing costs will be. And we'll be utilizing it to produce the departmental earnings report that is due to the legislature in January of 2015. Our final functionality that we are going to develop in the system will be to load the enacted budget from the budget system back into SWIFT, which is our accounting system, as well as include information on monthly revenues. The fiscal note tracking system will go live in January of 2015 to be used for the next legislative session.
Excuse me, Ms. Weber, I got to, as long as SWIFT came up,
sure.
How are we doing with SWIFT? I mean, I know last year when we were working on the budget, at that particular time, things were sometimes not what we hoped they'd be. Is that improved immeasurably, or I haven't heard anything about it lately.
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, I am not an expert in SWIFT, but I know that the agency has improved things significantly. But we could certainly ask someone to come speak with you who is an expert in the statewide accounting system.
All right. Thank you.
So with the fiscal note system, as I mentioned, we're planning to go live with that in January of 2015. It will have all of the existing functionality that exists in the existing fiscal note tracking system. In addition, it will have security in place to accommodate what are designated as classified fiscal notes, which was a result of recent legislation which allows an author to indicate on language that has not yet been introduced that they'd like what's called a private fiscal note to be produced on it. And so the new system will have security to accommodate that. We'll also have improved functionality where it will allow data to be exported to the system and into Excel to help with legislative staff tracking sheets and spreadsheets that are produced. We've also worked with stakeholders and the legislature on the fiscal note document and improving the display of information, providing more summary information of the impact of the proposed legislation by fund as a table on the front of the fiscal note, and including things like absorbed cost on consolidated fiscal notes if they're reported by an agency. We will also be separating out transfers from expenditures and revenues on the fiscal notes when the new system goes live. With the capital budget system, our plan is to go live with that in May of 2015 to support the capital budget submission that will happen in January of 2016. It will be combining three separate processes and systems into one system. It will support both the requests that are made by state agencies as well as requests that are made by local units of government. And then it will provide support for the governor's decision-making process. We have engaged local units of government in the requirements for that system, and they will also be involved in testing the system with us. It will be a web-based system that users can log into through separate access and security codes. In terms of all three of the systems, overall the successes that we've seen is we do remain within budget for all three of the systems. We also have put together risk management plans, and we are updating them on a monthly basis and going over them with our steering committee. And we've got well-defined requirement documents for both BPAS and the fiscal note tracking system and are in the process of developing those requirements for the capital budget system. Some of the risks that we've experienced thus far are delays in obtaining technical staff and hiring technical staff. That's been a bit of a challenge for us. We also, with taking on the development of three system, we are designating some existing staff to work on those projects, and it is an overwhelming task for us to have all three systems going on at the same time. And then finally, with both the BPAS system and the capital budget system, we did purchase an off-the-shelf software product. And with an off-the-shelf software product, there are certain limitations to what the technology can do, and so we've had to engage in some business practice changes as a result of that.
Questions? Ms. Weber, you mentioned under risks on project outlook the delays in obtaining technical staff and contractors. Is that because there's not a lot of people around? Is that we can't compete in hiring? Or what's the tale there?
Mr. Chair, that has been our experience. We've had a couple positions that we've posted for three times, and without having qualified candidates or candidates that we could offer the position to. We do also have Minute here if you wanted to speak with them about it, because I think it's a broader experience that we're seeing in the metro area in particular, both with competitive wage as well as skill set, and that there is a very low unemployment rate in the technology field right now.
Other question, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Weber, you say the risk here of technical limitations with off-the-shelf software. Examples of your technical limitations that you have?
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, an example that we've experienced with it is that previously, and we've overcome this hurdle through some creative problem solving, but previously the off-the-shelf software would store text, so if there's narrative information, a descriptive information, and then there's data about the financial information, getting those two things lined up to be together on one report so that you could see the text and the data together, we had some complexities with that. With the fiscal note system, for example, we know that that is such an important component. We're doing a custom build development rather than using an off-the-shelf software product for that.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Weber, you mentioned further back that you're going to load the budget planning and adoption system into SWIFT. Mm-hmm. If you're having trouble now with BPP, AS, and CBS, are you working then with the SWIFT, with people that are working on SWIFT to kind of make sure that this uploading of this program into SWIFT is going to be compatible?
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair and members, the product that we're using both for SWIFT and for BPAS they're both Oracle products, software products that are intended to be able to line the data up with each other. So we are working with the SWIFT team. We will work with the SWIFT team, too, as we develop that functionality. I don't expect there to be the example I gave of the text and data issue wouldn't be the same, because in both the budget system and the accounting system, we have what are referred to as appropriations that the dollars are assigned to, and those do exist in both systems, so we should be able to line those up.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Ms. Weber, you mentioned being able to meet the timelines that are being required. Is this going to further back? Are you still going to be able to meet the timeline, or is this going to reverse and we're going to have more time?
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson. We are expecting to meet the timelines with the departmental earnings report to be able to submit that in January when it comes to BPAS. We have, our steering committee did recently approve the delay of the implementation of the compensation tool for agencies. We had been planning to have that available in August of this year, but we are looking to make it available in April of 2015 for agencies.
So that's a delay of about 8 months?
Correct.
Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Thank you, Ms. Weber. Next, we have Commissioner O'Brien.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Ann O'Brien, Assistant Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget in the Enterprise Human Resources Division. And I'm here to talk about the talent management projects and initiatives that we received funding for last year. $4 million to implement the new talent management system software, our recruiting solutions, which is our application processing system, and $1.8 million to add staff to support our enterprise human resource initiatives in our talent management area. First, Lori Hansen will discuss the implementation of our recruiting solutions project.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Hansen.
Lori Hansen, Enterprise Human Resources. On page 3 of the slides that you have, just a reminder about why we're going into a replacement of our current applicant tracking system, which we refer to as our Resimex system. Our current software vendor is out of business since 2005. Our third-party support is no longer available for that system, and we only have one in-house technical person that can support it. So what will we get with our new system? We've got a system now that will integrate with our current human resource information system, Semaphore. We will be able to identify and implement process efficiencies as we go forward. We'll have improved reporting capabilities and really improved quality in our applicant pools. On the next slide, there's a high-level project schedule. You can see that we started in October. We're planning to end in September. We have finished stages 1, 2, and 3. We are currently in the design and configure stage of this project. The project is moving according to this timeline. On page 5, so what progress have we made to date? We certainly have staff and contractors that have been hired to help us. They're augmenting our current staff. We have both M&B staff now and these contractor staff on board. We also have engaged our stakeholders. We had something that we referred to as a fit gap session and a Kaizen session that we held late last year, early this year. The fit gap session had 15 state agencies that came in and participated with us in a two-week process where we reviewed the requirements that we had put together for our for the new system that we wanted to have. So we looked at the system, we looked at our requirements, and we made determinations about how well the system fit what it is that we needed it to do. Those same agencies then were asked to participate with us in a Kaizen event. And a Kaizen is a lean or a continuous improvement process. So we examined our hiring process during that event from the point at which the agency is preparing the job announcement all the way through the process to the point where the offer is made to the candidate. And we felt really strongly that this process was needed so that we didn't automate bad or inefficient processes into our new system. And so what did we learn with that process? We learned that as our hiring process right now takes us an average of 57.7 days, and we also identified 19 opportunities for improvement in our hiring process. So right now what we're doing is we're working to get work groups together to go through and look at those 19 different ideas and that came into us through that Kaizen event. And hopefully those will be moving forward very soon.
Good. Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Any other questions? Okay. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the only other, we've listed some other positions that we are filling toward that end of business process reengineering, improving our recruitment activities, our ability to attract and retain talent, and help agencies with workforce planning and other initiatives in order to position ourselves as as an employer that individuals would like to work with and have their career with us, and you can read those, and if there's any other questions, I can leave those with you, and if there's questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. O'Brien, we have a lot of veterans that are coming back from overseas and a lot of people that have experience in different areas through their military work. I'm wondering how many veterans have applied, or you're working with them, or are other things that they can be brought into working in a state agency. If you can give me some details or some thoughts on that.
Ms. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we recently completed the veterans report, which we do annually, and it actually went out this morning to the legislature. And we have several initiatives that we report in that report. We actually work, state agencies work quite closely with veterans groups. There are initiatives in most state agencies to work with veterans and increase the number of veterans in employment. And currently we have statistics that show that we employ veterans in numbers that are greater than the number of veterans in the general public. So we are very proud of those statistics. We also have the legislative initiatives that require us to look at recently separated veterans as a part of additional employment opportunities for veterans so that they are afforded the opportunity for interviews. And then we have the Veterans Preference Initiatives that we have on statute as part of our hiring incentives. But we do have several other programs that we that state agencies participate in. But I would be happy to forward that report to you as well.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. O'Brien, really what I want to know is how many veterans do you have hired or have you hired and now are employed in state agencies with you or others that you work with? So if you can give me those numbers, that would be great. I'd like to know, and what percentage of those vets make up your total workforce?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner O'Brien.
Senator, I'd be happy to get you those numbers. I have them in that report.
Thank you.
And Commissioner, we've had other presenters who are going to bring us more information, and so that'd be great if you could do that. Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you all for coming today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Department of Military Affairs, Don Kerr, Executive Director for the Department of Military Affairs.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too, sir. Well, first, call your attention to our handout that's coming around. We did provide it for the committee today, a copy of our slides, a copy of our annual report, which has a lot more information about our performance in the last year, and also a copy of the report back to the legislature regarding the Support Our Troops account, which was one of the special topic areas that Mr. Berger made us aware of. I will go briefly through our slide pack and try to get to the ones that the committee asked about, so that we can get there, but we do think there's some important stuff in what we have done in the last year that we wanted to update you on and what some of the challenges facing the agency are moving forward. And with that, I will move out.
Sounds good.
So there is our agenda. The Adjutant General's six priorities have not changed. These are the priorities that guide the activities of the agency and everything that we do. We are seeing a shift right now in what is taking most of our time. And this is mostly from a federal level. Right now, there is an interesting conversation going on about the force structure of the Army in general, following up on a conversation that the Air Force started with itself here a couple of years ago, where we're seeing similar outcomes. So that's taking a lot of our time right now. Sustainable infrastructure is also very important to us. That has to do with our ability to continue to occupy our armories and use the facilities that we have around the state. And, of course, the last one listed, cybersecurity and response, is an emerging area that becomes more interesting every year and more clearly defined every year, and we are seeing that come to fruition with more specific objectives that we're able to establish annually. Our economic impact in the state, these are the numbers for 2013. The state numbers are on the state fiscal year that's actual expended, and the federal are on the federal fiscal year actual extended, so it's a little bit of an apples and apricot comparison, but it's relatively close. Statewide presence, we have a structure or a force in 63 communities around the state, well distributed. We feel we're in a very important part of community, particularly out in greater Minnesota. Hot topics that the agency has faced in 2013, and I will go to my script to cover these, but the Department of Defense announced several policy changes in 2013 regarding women who serve in the military, including rescinding the ground combat exclusion rule, which prevented women from being assigned to combat units below the brigade level. Minnesota National Guard's 1st Armored Brigade Combat Team volunteered to be one of the test brigades to incorporate women into positions within units at the headquarters level of combat arms battalions that were previously unavailable to them. The Minnesota Department of Health released its most recent suicide data in August, highlighting an increase in adult suicides. The statewide suicide statistics followed a national trend, and the Minnesota National Guard is not exempt from the societal issue. Reported suicides in the Minnesota Army National Guard are the highest in the nation. As a result, we have developed robust suicide prevention efforts. Our soldiers and airmen are our most valuable resources, and the well-being of our members is the top concern of our leaders. We do not believe that we have solved this problem. We are continuing to apply resources toward it, but we do recognize that it's much larger than just our team. It really is a societal problem. Members of the Minnesota National Guard are not immune to sexual harassment or assault. Sexual assault is a crime and a problem that violates everything we in the Minnesota Army and Air National Guard stand for. Through rigorous bystander intervention training, victim advocates in every unit, and soldier and airman stand downs, the Minnesota National Guard is working to bolster a supportive culture throughout our organization. We demand that our soldiers and airmen live up to the core values of military service. We hold each soldier and airman accountable for their actions and insist that our members intervene when they encounter a situation that could lead to sexual violence.
Excuse me,
yes, sir.
Mr. Director, we have a question. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerr, the Women in Combat, I take it was just implemented last year. Have we lost any individual women through combat from the state of Minnesota or from the nation? Also, suicide prevention. How many women are included in the statistics of people who have committed suicide that are women? And also in the sexual assault area, what number of women have been assaulted, if you have those statistics or you know them right at this moment?
Mr. Director.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, we do have those that data. Actually, I may have difficulty with the first one you asked about women killed in action or lost in combat. I know that we have had female combat losses nationally. I do not believe we have had any in the Minnesota National Guard. The propensity of suicide among our members, I believe, has been strictly male to this point. However, we're watching those data very closely, and what we have really found is that we have not been successful in identifying potential suicide victims before they become suicide victims. We have identified, have been able to identify numerous cases of suicidal ideation and have been able to intervene and believe that we have saved lives, but I do not know offhand what the distribution, male-female. However, I can get that data for you, Senator, and I'll get that back to you. With regard to the sexual assault awareness and response, the majority of those cases that we're dealing with in the Minnesota National Guard do involve female members, but not all of them. And again, I can get that data, and I'll report it back to the committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And regarding women in combat, you said that probably we don't have any fatalities as far as women. Do we have any people that have been disabled because of their roles in combat where they've been maimed or they've been, you know, they're in a disabled position as a wounded woman in combat, from combat?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, same answer. I don't believe so, but I'll have to check on that to be
okay.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last bullet on this page, in 2013, Minnesota National Guard was affected by the $46 billion budget cuts to the Department of Defense. due to sequestration and furloughs impacted every branch and component of the Department of Defense. We had more than 1,100 uniformed Minnesota National Guard technicians that faced 6 days of administrative furlough between July 15th and August 19th. Now, these same technicians, along with other members of our force, were furloughed again on October 1st when Congress failed to avert a government shutdown. I would add that though they were reimbursed for the pay lost after the October 1st shutdown, they were not made whole for the sequestration furloughs that occurred in the previous year. Continued budget cuts and furloughs could put Minnesota National Guard readiness at risk. Each day that equipment and facilities go without maintenance and soldiers and airmen go untrained has a negative impact on the Minnesota National Guard's ability to fully support the broad range of federal and state missions that we face. To this date, 350 deployed currently. More are preparing. We have about 250 soldiers that currently are serving with a notification of sourcing that we anticipate will deploy in the coming 12 months. So we think that though this number is the lowest it's been in a decade or more, we think it's probably flatlined and will not reduce below about that 250 to 300 based on the data that we're seeing now, despite the indication that we will cease operations in Afghanistan in 2014. Over that decade, we have operated in 33 countries and on every continent of the globe, including Antarctica. We have some folks from 133rd Airlift Wing supporting operations at the scientific base in Antarctica occasionally. State active duty, this is a summary going back to 2005 on the number of manned days that we have devoted to state active duty. Not included in the grand total are an additional 4 state active duty days that we've accumulated this year with the winter storms. As a side note, the current forecast indicates that we do not have a grave concern for flooding this year. Apparently, the moisture content of the snowpack in the Red River Valley is fairly low, but it's also early March, so a lot of things could change. And depending on how the melt happens, Mother Nature will determine what's going to happen there. But we're fairly optimistic at this point. So I'll move into the special topic areas. The Support Our Troops account. Back to my scripture to make sure that I'm not goofing this up. It's a special revenue account established in statute in 2005 that's appropriated in equal shares to the Department of Military Affairs and the Department of Veterans Affairs from the sale of Support Our Troops license plates. For the Department of Military Affairs, the statute authorizes the 4 uses that are depicted on the slide. Since the inception of the fund, the agency has not exercised the first use, that is, we have not chosen to do grants directly to individuals. Instead, we have used the Minnesota Military Family Foundation under the provisions of subparagraph B there as our agent to do those grant distributions. So the way that process works, our family assistance centers around the state are usually the points of contact for our service members that have a need to request a grant. The family assistance center puts them in contact with the MMFF folks, and they usually get an adjudication on that grant, whether they are eligible and should be dispersed or not within 24 hours, and then they make that disbursement, and at the end of the fiscal year, we reimburse MMFF for the grants that they have provided. And I believe I have that here. This year, yes, I do. In the last calendar year, there were 143 grants requested. 65 of those were determined to be eligible, disbursing $119,942. We included the data from the previous 3 years to give you a little comparison. You can see that we did have a little bit of an increase when we had heavier mobilizations, and we appear to have turned the corner, and that number is moving down. We also have the authority to provide grants to family readiness groups chartered by the Adjutant General. We have about 60 of those groups out there. In the last calendar year, only 7 of them applied for the grants because that's where the need was. And those generally correspond to family readiness groups for units that are deployed. That's as we look at the data of which family readiness groups have requested those grants, that's generally the group that's requesting those grants. Additionally, we're authorized to perform veteran services. Mr. McKelleny briefed earlier that they expended about $43,000 in this fiscal year. This disbursement to the Department of Veterans Affairs was technically in the last fiscal year, but also in calendar year 13. So it appears to be doubling up, but that's not really accurate. So they have been able to bring that event in at a lower budget than what we were previously doing it for. We also dispersed $1,765.42 to support a Strong Bonds relationship development event, and we have expended $45,000 for a licensed drug and alcohol coordinator as an employee to provide services to members of the National Guard and their families. I would add that we are currently in the process of hiring a second licensed drug and alcohol counselor. This was identified as one of the areas of shortfall that we have on the federal support side. And what we were finding, not only in our suicide research, but generally in our family assistance programs, that often when soldiers and their families have trouble, they're based in more than one trouble area. They may be financial, along with a drug problem or an alcohol problem, along with not being able to get a job, and all of those things kind of manifest themselves, and it really becomes a case management challenge. We also did find a strong correspondence to drug and alcohol abuse that we felt we needed to deal with. And so bringing on this licensed drug and alcohol coordinator has really allowed us to do a better job getting our service members and their families linked with the resources they need to help fix their problems. Any
Senator
other
Anderson,
questions?
Excuse me.
Yes,
Senator Anderson, did you have a question?
Yes.
Excuse me, Director.
Mr. Kerr, the drug and alcohol counselor that you're talking about, at least when I was in the military, if you were caught with drugs, it was an automatic expulsion. Has there been a change in the way that we're handling people that have drug problems?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, generally, Senator Anderson, if a soldier or airman self-refers, they are not disciplined for their use. If they are caught using through a urinalysis, they are disciplined or dealt with administratively and often discharged. However, we have found that there are certain cases where self-referral by the individuals, it's very useful for us to be able to try to rehabilitate that service member, since we have a fairly substantial investment in training those service members. It's really worth our time if we can fix their problem and get them off drugs and alcohol so that they can be contributing members again. It's usually worth our time and effort due to the investment that we make in their training.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kerr, then, so how many people do we have that have self-referred or have been found to have drugs? Is there a percentage? And I mean, having been overseas and knowing the situations that you can get yourself into as a military person, what are we experiencing today?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I'll give you a little bit of data and I'll report back with better numbers, but I know right now our licensed drug and alcohol coordinator is operating 45 active cases today, or within two or three of that, depending. It was about a week and a half ago that I got the briefing, but I'll provide some more data on how many have referred. One of the challenges we have, Senator Anderson, is that many of our members are not full-time members of the military. And so we get a lot of spillover into what's going on in their civilian life, oftentimes when we have no jurisdiction over what they're doing for well or ill. And our licensed drug and alcohol coordinator has been extremely busy trying to coordinate activities so that we can provide these services to our soldiers, airmen, and their families. And I'll get some better data for you and report that back to the committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Director. Continue.
Into the budget. So I'll start by talking the center line first. Mr. Chair, as you know, there are actually four areas. The fourth area is emergency services, and that basically is a placeholder amount that goes in based on analysis of previous state active duty requirements. So we'll talk about the three that are somewhat that we have some control over. The general support account, this is the annual number, $2.36 million in that. And believe it or not, I'm going to put in a plug in favor of SWIFT. This may be the first time in history this has occurred in this building. But what we have found over the last 3 years, through much pain and agony, we have been able to work the system to a point where we feel we have very good visibility over where our expenditures are and where they're going to be. And it's really improved our visibility. Right now, we're showing that we expect to execute that account with about $7,400 out of a $2.36 million budget by 30 June. and we're watching that very closely, but we're very confident that we'll bring it in at that point. And of course, that 7,400 will carry into the next year of the biennium. And our success in that is making us very optimistic that we feel very confident with our financial estimates and where we are. The maintenance of training facilities account, that's $6.66 million a year. Our current data shows us to overdrive that account by about $200,000. We are over-obligated right now. The reason we're over-obligated there is because of higher-than-anticipated heat, fuel, and electrical bills. However, we believe that we will have resolved the problem before we get to the end of the state fiscal year because the federal government is on the hook for paying some of those bills, and we should be able to balance those obligations so that we do end the fiscal year. So we'll be in the black. We will not be in the red. How far in the black, I'm not sure. We'll be pretty close. But again, because of the improved visibility that we feel we have over our accounts now, we're very comfortable moving forward, and we'll be able to tell you that we'll be right where we need to be at the end of this fiscal year and likely into next fiscal year. And now feel that we have the ability to kind of slow down projects if we have to, or speed them up so that we can hit the marks. The short answer there is we do not anticipate coming forward for a supplemental budget this year. We feel that we have adequate resources for the biennium in those two accounts. With regard to the enlistment
incentives. We always appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the enlistment incentives account, we kind of have a problem there in that we have been anticipating pent-up demand that we are not seeing manifest itself. We are continuing to run that below the budgeted amount, and at some point we're going to have to deal with that. Now, from the agency's perspective, this is good news because this is money that carries forward for us year to year. But we are under-executing and have been for the last 3 years, and so we're going to have to make some sort of a structural adjustment to figure out how to deal with that, and we hope to be able to do that in a fashion that it doesn't screw it up down the road. But that is an area that we're watching very closely. We had two things not come to pass that we thought would come to pass. We did not have the pent-up demand that we anticipated for the use of that account in state tuition reimbursement program following our last large mobilization and deployment. And we have not seen the federal benefit package drop off as precipitously as we expected it to, despite all of the challenges we're having with the federal budget. Many of the tuition assistance programs are still in effect and are still we don't allow our service members to double up. So if they're getting federal money, they don't get the state money. We make them whole to 100%, but that's where we're capped out. So we are not executing enlistment incentives at the rate that we expected to. Again, this is a good problem to have. But it is something we're going to have to deal with at some point nonetheless. That concludes my piece of the budget portion. I did feel compelled to come in and give the committee an update to where we're at with our education center addition at Camp Ripley. As you may recall, Mr. Chair, two years ago, we received $19.5 million in bonding to do a fairly substantial addition to the education center, and we're moving forward with that. We were able to post a bid on the 25th of April of 13, and we began construction on 8 October of 13. Great time to start building a really big outdoor building. And we anticipate completion of the building by 1 March of 15. So about a year from now, we should have furniture in that place, and we'll be heating it up. To give you an idea of what that looks like, these are the major features that were designed in. Our original intent was to get 40 hotel-style rooms. We were able, since the original project came in under budget, to execute some branches that we had in that, and we're able to add 8 additional rooms. The dining facility will seat 380. That's a significant upgrade from our current dining facility, which will seat about 60. There will be a 200-seat auditorium, one large classroom that's dividable, and then the 6 48-person classroom. So that enhances our capability at Camp Ripley quite substantially. We're also very pleased that we've been able to run some sustainability features into the design that will make us very competitive and allow us to operate the facility very economically into the future.
Mr. Director, with this new facility, I have no doubt that you'll be able to more efficiently and bring more people in. Do you have some estimates of just how many more people that you'll be able to train and?
Mr. Chair, we have done that analysis. I don't have that data available to me right now, but I'll get it back to you and make a report back.
That'd be great. Thank you.
So to give you an idea, this is an overview of the area. the existing education center. There's the mouse. The existing education center is right here. I consider that to be a fairly large building. You see, we're more than doubling the size of that. The area in pink here are the classrooms. This is the dining facility area, and this is where the lodging is going up. And I've got a better view of that in a bird's eye view. This would be from the northeast. And again, the existing building is this one right here. And we're adding classroom space here, dining facility there, and the lodging here. There's a southern exposure, same type thing. Existing building here. And there are some photos of the construction on the tundra that is proceeding. And as you can see, they've actually made pretty good headway, particularly with the billeting portion. Moving right ahead, even though been a very brutal winter. They are currently about 21 days behind schedule, but we are okay on the critical path and anticipate making up some of those float days. So we think we're going to finish on time and certainly on budget, and it'll be a great facility when we're done with it. And we appreciate the generosity of the legislature for providing that to us.
Question, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kerr, on the national level, there's been a proposal to downgrade the size of the military, and I'm wondering if you have any indication how Minnesota will be impacted by that decrease in size. Are any of our bases being targeted? I know we've been in targeted before and making, you know, getting rid of some different squadrons and battalions and things like that. I'm just wondering if you have any indication as to how this might impact us.
Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson, we, of course, the future of the Army's force structure is still being debated. We have done some analysis based on what we think the worst-case scenarios are and some of the best-case scenarios. In the worst-case scenario, Minnesota could lose about 1,000 positions, so that would be about 1,000 fewer members of the Minnesota National Guard. Obviously, that would be a negative thing from our perspective, from a readiness perspective, but also from a capabilities perspective. What we don't know is what the composition, the force composition of those cuts might be. And, of course, we use dual-use equipment that's provided by the federal government to support state active duty. We don't anticipate there being a terrible impact, but certainly not something that we're looking forward to. We think that it's the wrong time to be cutting the reserve. It's very interesting to step back from this, and I know it's very easy to see the reserve component competing with the active component for resources. And probably if you're trying to manage that thing, that's what it looks like to you. But from a broader strategic perspective, as the nation steps back from war, it probably makes more sense to use a smaller active component in a larger reserve so that you have a place for the folks that are being displaced from your active component to be able to maintain a level of training and availability to the nation so that you're not just walking away from that investment. There, as the Army reduces in size, we anticipate that most of their reductions will come at the mid-grade. So 10-year captains, 10-year staff sergeants that we've invested a lot of blood and treasure to train will suddenly become irrelevant because there won't be a place for them to go. If you expand the size of the reserve, they could be absorbed into the reserve, and the nation could recapture some of that investment. But with the current plans to downsize both the active component and the reserve component at the same time, the reserve component will close ranks and there won't be room. So I personally have trouble understanding the logic behind the philosophy, but that debate will continue, and I'm sure in the end it will be resolved in the Congress. And that probably will be good for us.
Other questions? Director, thanks a lot. Great report, and appreciate the visuals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members.
Next, we have Department of Administration, Spencer Kroc, the Commissioner. Commissioner?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair,
Mr.
members.
Mr. Woloski, it's good to see you, too.
See you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Proceed. We're glad to see you here today.
Great. Thanks for having me. For the record, my name is Spencer Kronk, the Commissioner of the Department of Administration, and it's a pleasure to be here before you today to give you an update on the department. As you know, our mission is to provide the best value in government administrative services. We do this through customer satisfaction, continuous improvement, and employee engagement. We have a diverse array of services that we offer at the Department of Administration, and I took slide 3 just to show a little bit about the results that have occurred in the last year. This should be in your handout. Does everyone have a handout in front of them? Great. So some of the results we've seen across the department included reducing workplace injuries throughout the enterprise by over 10%, saving taxpayers an estimated $2.8 million. We also work hard to strategically work on vendor negotiations. So when a vendor comes in at a certain bid price, our negotiators really work with them to bring that price down to save taxpayers money as well and to avoid costs. We saw over $33 million of avoided costs in fiscal year 13. We do the same for lease negotiations on the state buildings that are on the lease buildings that we have throughout state agencies. We also have a Council of Development of Disabilities that is in the Department of Administration, and they created a great iPhone app this past year, and we've seen over 25,000 downloads regarding the autism spectrum disorder. So there are great public service offerings like that the department pursues. I wanted to spend the bulk of my presentation on the change items that occurred in this past legislative session. There were three small but strategic investments that the legislature made into programs that the department offers. These were all around enterprise efficiency and accountable government services, and they were on our expansion of our lean continuous improvement program, our small agency resource team, and then also creating an internal audit function for the department itself. I'll start with our lean continuous improvement program. The increase that we received this past legislative session for fiscal year 14-15 was around $250,000 a year. That allowed us to hire two new FTEs for the department. This brought our team to 3 people total. But those are, again, our strategic investments that we're really able to use throughout the enterprise. You heard from the Department of Management and Budget that they used a Kaizen event to look at their hiring process, and that was facilitated by one of these new lean continuous improvement facilitators. So the investments were already paying off. We trained over 1,600 employees in 22 different state agencies in fiscal year 13. So again, it's a great program. We have another slide that shows a little bit more examples that are throughout the enterprise, but we've seen tremendous success in making these strategic investments. The small agency resource team provides human resource and financial services for councils, boards, and commissions that are very small, maybe 1 to 10 people total, and so it's not in their best interest to have a specific person dedicated to HR, a specific person dedicated to their own financial management. So we provide those services for them in a shared service format. We have a total of 5 FTEs working on that. The increase that we received last year allowed us to add 2 FTEs, to bring it to a total of 5. So we had 3 in the past, and now we have 5 total. And now we're serving 17 entities. And on slide 9, you can see all the different clients that we have as part of the SMART program. And they include the tax court, which we added as a result of this investment, but the Council on Black Minnesotans, the Indian Affairs Council, the Secretary of State, Public Utilities Commission. We can certainly expand on this list, and we're being thoughtful about how we take on these new clients, but this investment has allowed us to really come up with a strategy of working with these different boards and councils, making sure that we understand what their financial and human resource needs are, and then working out a MOU or an understanding with them on what type of services we were providing for them. And you can see a list of what those services are on slide 8. And then the third strategic investment was to create an internal auditor within the department. We had one, an internal auditor about 10 years ago, but that funding was diminished, I think, in 2002 around. But we wanted to make sure that we had our own house in order. We have over 14 different business units within the department, and they all have unique processes that require specialized skills to ensure that we have accurate financial data and accountability. We did hire someone a couple months ago, and they have been an incredible asset already, really proving their worth. We want to make sure that each of the business units are working with our internal auditor to avoid any complications that may arise. So it's been a great asset so far, and we know that the results and the risks that we're avoiding will prove themselves worthwhile in the future.
Commissioner, that person, internal auditor, is he more of an accountant, or is he more of a risk manager, or how would you describe him or her?
It's a him at this point in time. I'm somewhat of a risk manager. I mean, so the legislative auditor acts as an auditor for the entire executive branch. And this is somebody that we can have internally within the department because we are such a unique and specialized department where we have a number of business units. And so they really, what we do are internal controls and a risk assessment at the senior leadership team level and identify a number of areas that we really need to dive into deeper. And so our internal auditor helps us and works with the different divisions to ensure that we can look at our accounts payable system if that's something that's at a higher risk than other payroll process or other processes within the department. So a risk manager is probably the best way to characterize that.
Thank you. Go ahead. Thanks.
Unless there are any questions about the investments that were made last legislative session, I'll just touch briefly on our unsession proposal, which should be presented to you. I believe it's jacketed, and the House has an author, and it's still awaiting an author in the Senate. But we really wanted to look at our current statutes within the Department of Administration, and we focused on 16B and C, and there were three main goals. One was to make sure that we consolidated the responsibilities in each of those chapters into their appropriate chapter. There were things that related to procurement that were in the wrong chapter, and so we wanted to make sure everything that was related to procurement went into 16B. So it was just a little bit of reorganization, making sure that the headers were clear, that people could see logical categories. This is mainly for reusers, the 25,000 vendors that do business with the state, that they can understand what the statutes look like and how they could understand it from their perspective. We also wanted to make sure that there was consistency within the professional technical contracting, that there was we were proposing to increase the threshold for goods and services procurement, which was once $5,000 to do a solicitation, and now we've increased that to $25,000. This is going to be an incredible improvement for how agencies go about doing their own purchasing for goods and services, and there's consistency across the statute itself. But it is a risk analysis, and that was followed by the OLA recommendation to make sure that we're focused, where our team is focused on the higher risk contracts and not spending their time on the $5,000 contracts.
Senator Champion.
Just a question, Commissioner. So did I hear you say that you are looking at changing that threshold hold number so that it goes up to 25,000? And so what will you do, and what will be the recording requirements for those lesser contracts, let's say?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it will be the same reporting requirements as they are under $5,000, and so they'll be working within the department themselves, but they won't be brought to the department administration. So, for example, if DNR is purchasing something that was $4,000 and now they can purchase something that was $12,000, if this proposal goes forward, they would be able to do that internally, and they won't have to have that oversight by the department administration. Again, our overall responsibility is to look at the overall procurement of the state and make sure that it's managed well, and this just focuses our risks on those higher value contracts.
Senator.
But wouldn't you agree that and I definitely look forward to seeing this language, because I think this is the same language or similar to something you all were trying to do last year, which was to or at least I think it is. But correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't there some requirement that if it's at a certain dollar level for there to be some inclusion considerations or something of that nature? Can you help me understand that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'd have to get a little bit more clarification from you, but you know, certainly that the inclusion considerations are for all contracts, and so you know the preferences that are applied to minority and women-owned firms, regardless of threshold, and so those would be affected by this change.
Thank you.
But I can follow up with you separately and ensure that that language makes sense and is different than what you were describing.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, go ahead, Director.
And then the third piece on the on-session bill was really to make sure that we were focusing on those delivering effective and efficient services. And there were some requirements in our statutes that were in other statutes. There were some things that, you know, talked about telegraph services or micrographics that we just wanted to get rid of. So we have reviewed this with a number of members, and we wanted to make sure that everyone was comfortable with the new language. But
well, Commissioner, I think a couple of things. One, in the discussions that we've had when we started on this whole on-session gamut was that when it got right down to it, and I think this is the right way to do it, nothing here is particularly controversial. It's just that everybody can agree that this is a good thing to do, and consequently that's why it's been done. Mm-hmm. We aren't trying to pull anybody's strings here. And then the question is, were there any costs involved in any of these on-session?
To create the Mr. Chair, to create the proposals, or that would result from?
It would result from the on-session.
You know, the one that I can think of was reflective of what Senator Champion mentioned. And so if some of those additional work that our department currently does for those contracts between $5,000 and $25,000, if that's the proposal, that work would be not necessary anymore, and so my staff could focus on the higher value contracts. But I can we did an analysis on how many of those contracts exist throughout the state, and potentially how many hours would be saved as a result of that. So I can make sure that the committee has that information.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner.
Senator
Anderson. Go ahead. Would you follow up? Senator?
I was going to follow up, Mr. Chair. I think your comments are well intended, and I do think that there are times as public policymakers that we are focusing on streamlining things and there are unintended consequences. Yeah. And I think this might be one of those areas where there's unintended consequences, and that's why I will look forward to hearing what the commissioner is going to say later, is because smaller businesses like your veteran-owned businesses or your firms of color may not have the capacity to do some of your higher-end contracts, and therefore their work lies within the smaller contracts. But if they're overlooked and there's no accountability notions around how do we make sure that these firms are really being considered, because guess what happens? No one continues to look anymore. Right. So they look someplace else, and then people can do whatever they want to do, and they may be well-intentioned, but then that's where you get the whole idea where if someone's my friend, it's a smaller contract, it doesn't have to go through the scrutiny, so why don't we just continue to do the work that we need to do? Mm-hmm. And if the contract threshold level is $25,000, what if I did it for $24,000? And now there's no scrutiny involved. And so I think that we're all in good intention, but I think there's reasons why those provisions were put that way, and I look forward to hearing that information sometime later.
Right, and Senator Champion, in the discussions that I participated in, your points are well taken. We don't know, and that's why we're going to discuss them, and that's why they're here today. Good. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Cronk, you mentioned women and minorities, and Senator Champion mentioned veteran-owned businesses. Do you have a handle on how many veteran-owned businesses you deal with on the administration right now as far as?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, not offhand, but I can certainly get you that information.
Appreciate that.
Yep.
Thank you.
And just to, an earlier point from the question from the chair, if your question was around if there's a fiscal note attached to our on-session bill, there is not at all.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Good. Senator Anderson, did you have your question answered? Okay, very good. Any other questions? All right. Thanks, Commissioner. And we're going to move on to Mr. Woloski.
Mr. Chair, members, Wayne Wislosky. I'm the Director of Real Estate and Construction Services for the Department of Administration. We're going to pick it up on slide 12 of the same handout. And it's a pleasure to be back to give you an update on capital restoration. Just jumping to slide 13, we're going to just walk through real quickly what work has been done to date around the design process. We're going to do a brief overview of the budget for capital restoration schedule, as well as construction work that's been completed to date. Just to bring everybody back, this process started in 2011 with the creation of the Capital Preservation Commission. They worked through the fall of 2011, and in February of 2012, they approved the master plan for restoration of the Capitol. In May of 2012, we received the first appropriation, went through the procurement process to select both the design and construction team that would be working on the project, and really the project got underway in the fall of 2012. Completed schematic design in May of 2013, and that Preservation Commission reviewed that and approved the schematic design in July of 2013. And now we're moving forward with the design work. Construction started, abatement and demolition started in the basement in September of 2013, and everybody can see that firsthand. At the same time, we were continuing with the design work. Design development documents were submitted in January of this year, and that led to budget reconciliation process and currently now moving into construction documents, preparation of construction documents for the rest of the restoration project. Slide 14, just a brief overview, reminder, this process on the design started with design scoping workshops. We wanted to engage as many stakeholders as we could throughout the developing and defining the scope of the restoration project. There were 11 workshops, and those workshops were completed in April 2013. Moving to slide 14, just the end result of those workshops was a set of design documents called schematic design, and there's obviously focuses on, at a very high level, the different aspects of the restoration project. Moving to the next slide, just talks about the completion. Those schematic design documents are still available on the Preservation Commission website. There's the address there, or the website link there, if you're interested in looking at those. And again, that schematic design was approved by the Preservation Commission of July of last year. Following that, we then moved into design development, and this is slide 17 on your handout. Those, again, it involves engaging the stakeholders, all the different tenant groups, ADA accessibility, the disabilities community, IT folks, just a broad range of stakeholders to progress the design and get into a lot more of the details. That design development, as mentioned, was completed on January 10th of 2014. Then it reaches a very critical step in the process, and that is what you want to do. Your scope of work, does it align with your budget? And so you go through a cost estimating process, and we've described that in some detail before, where we have three independent estimates on a project of this magnitude, and then we go through a process to reconcile those estimates both to themselves and then to our budget. And as you're going through that, quite honestly, you don't get everything you want. You have to set priorities, and you have to make decisions around value engineering, what provides the most value, for what's most important for the restoration project. And that process continues, that cost estimating and budget reconciliation process continues through the rest of the project. The next slide, slide 18, is talking a little bit about the space plans and what will the Capitol look like upon completion, and how will the Capitol be utilized. And really, just at a high level, want to highlight some of the improvements that the public's going to see. And it starts in the basement level, and you can see the outlines of that now. Those familiar with Hearing Room G15, we're replicating that space down in the basement, so you'll have the columns exposed, and that's going to be new public event space, and that will be right off of and adjacent to additional design dining capacity that's next to the Rathskeller. So there'll be seating for about 50 additional people off of the Rathskeller. It'll be an easy way for public events when people have their hill on the day and they bring in food service. They can gather in that space, bring in food service, and that would be an exciting new space, and we're looking forward to bringing that to fruition. Up on the ground level, if you think of the Great Hall to the west, is been that space where you've had public events, public gathering events. If you go to the east side, you see where the Capitol was, because there was lack of office space, that space was infilled with Senate Council and research offices. We were going to return that space back to Cass Gilbert's original design. We'll open that corridor back up to the public, and there will be historical society will have a classroom space off of that corridor, and there will also be a hearing room off of that corridor. Moving up to the first level, as you come up the steps and currently out in the public corridor, you have the small desk that Historical Society has to provide information. We'll now move that into a room, and it'll be much more of a public information room where House and Senate and what other activities are happening in the building that day. There will be a way to know what's happening and where it's happening, and there will also still be the small gift shop as well as opportunities to learn about the history and the architecture of the building. That location will still be operated by the Historical Society. One thing to mention, too, is just on the restrooms. That's one of the, again, improvements throughout the building on each floor, starting in the basement, right off the cantilever steps. You're going to have male and women's and men's restrooms, but you also on the first, ground first and third floor, there will be a family room. As our population ages, we often have family members that need assistance. That will be a family room for that to happen. There's also going to be a mother's room on the first floor that will be available for both people who work in the building as well as guests that come, visitors that need a nursing room. On the second floor, just off the rotunda space, we've had the food service that's been out in the public corridor. We're moving that into a room, and we're calling it a lunch counter space. So that will be, instead of having that spread throughout the public gathering spaces, there will actually be a room dedicated for that. There will be some seating in there and a more permanent location for those activities. And that mirrors up with the service in the Rathskeller. Obviously, the Rathskeller food services closes down around 2 o'clock, and that's when the food service on the second floor picks up. So that is an important function. So that's highlights for the committee, some of the improvements, functional improvements that the public will see. Moving on to the next slide, we'll get into more of the details related to the budget. Again, as mentioned, at the end of the design development, you do go through a cost estimating process. We're still working with an overall project budget of $272,700,000. Within these line items, there's lots of adjustments that happens. We certainly have a number of budget pressures on a project like this, and so we are moving dollars around within the overall budget, but understanding that we have to bring the project in within this budget. The next slide, slide 20, is a much more, just gives you a little bit more sense of the construction. Where is the dollars being invested in the capital? And bringing back to where this project started as an infrastructure improvement project. So a lot of the dollars are associated with mechanical, electrical, plumbing, telecommunications, and life safety and security system upgrades. And this gives just a little bit more detail on that. The next slide is an important slide to note, slide 21. It's called the additive alternates. ADALTs is what we call them. These are the things that didn't fit within the budget, within our cost estimate. But if we get favorable bids that come in, or we're not using our contingency, is still available, these are the things that we would look to potentially add back into the project. And this list will change over time and be revised. There's some things on this list that we really think are important and turned out to be not as feasible to take out, so we'll incorporate those into the project. But it's more demonstrative of how you manage a project of this magnitude. You're going to have things that don't fit within the budget, and you have to prioritize once if their funding comes available to complete those items. Slide 22 is just an update on this on the schedule. As noticed, we're doing it in four work packages. The first work package was the one that we started in June of 2013. That was the abatement and demolition down in the basement. We are now underway with the underpinning work. The work package two is work. That's underpinning. That's the structural underpinning. We're running ductwork underneath the concrete slabs, and so we have to do some structural supports. We're also doing procurement of mechanical, electrical, plumbing systems. Roof replacement will start around the May time frame, so you'll see a lot more activity picking up on the site. Work package three is demolition, structural, MEP, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, main lines. Work package four is the interior fit out and branch lines for the mechanical and the other systems. The table below is the exterior work that's been moving forward. Obviously, you're experiencing that firsthand with windows replacement in many of your offices. Exterior stonework is underway, and as French doors is the restoration of the French doors is just about wrapping up. Next slide is just an overview of these packages, and we don't have to spend a lot of time on these, but this just describes in a little bit more detail the work that goes into each, what's the scope within each of the work packages. If you slip, go all the way to slide 26, excuse me, it just talks a little bit more on detail on the exterior portions of the project, the stone, the windows, and the French doors. And then with that, on the next slide is some pictures to show you when we talk about selective restoration of the decorative features of on the exterior, these are some examples of components of the exterior that are being selectively stored. And the same on the next slide. Slide 29, also this project also involves many other smaller projects related to building out space and moving out tenants within the building. We have completed relocation of CAP security over to the administration building. The Capitol Press Corps is down at the Centennial Office Building. And this involves building out spaces so that those spaces work for them. So there's many small projects that go along with this. Upcoming relocations, I think many of you are aware, we're starting the work in June and July of this year in the East Wing. And so we're moving senators around and Senate staff around. And so we have some build-out projects first to complete for that. We're the fifth floor of the Centennial Office Building is currently a data center, repurposing that to office space to be used by Senate Council Research and others. Over in the State Office Building, we're repurposing the cafeteria space to be used by the House Sergeant at Arms, as well as the Chief Clerk's office, House Chief Clerk. House Media is going to be moving over to the State Office Building as well. So there's Governor's Office is moving down to the Vet Services Building. Those are all construction projects in and of themselves that we have to deliver and have them be completed in time to match up with capital restoration. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that quick once over. Mr. Woloski, I appreciate that. And I don't necessarily want to get into a big discussion on construction timetables. But there's when we talk about the actual new plan for the state capitol, does it not include quite a bit more room for the governor and quite a bit – well – that's kind of, I mean, without taking a lot of time, I mean, the change from what it is right now to what it will be in terms of who's using what space, could you give us a little bit of a rundown on that?
Mr. Chair, members, happy to give you a brief summary of that, but also can follow up with specific plans to show you kind of a before and after, and we're working on
square footage calculation. And in fact, that might be, and as you know, because you've been the leader of it, we can have specific field trips that can show us progress in the future, and that would be good. But I just because some of our timetables are starting to come up here, I'm just kind of interested to try to understand the square footage of the state capitol as is planned right now is going to be occupied by who and what amount.
Mr. Chair, Senator, and the members, the place to start with that is just first, if you just did the mechanical systems, the new exit stairs and the elevators, the restrooms, all that is taking up usable square footage. So you start there, and then you add in these public spaces, you know, the Great Hall to the east, moving in, creating a public events space, additional dining capacity, creating space for public information, a room for that goes. Those are all elements that are taking up space in the Capitol. So we'll we're currently running the calculations to based on the design development documents to determine how that breaks out. But that is where a significant amount of the space is being utilized. The tenants themselves, and we can show you a functional analysis of what changes are being made to tenant space and you know, each of the tenants that will remain in the Capitol are getting some additional space, and we'll show how, why is that needed, and why, when you're looking out of a restoration project over a 100-year period, why it makes sense to build in those functional changes. So happy to go into whatever level of detail that the committee wishes on that.
And so I've been told that this particular room that we're sitting in right now would be a House caucus room?
Mr. Chair, as would 107 across the hall. So you'd
or 112, right?
Yeah, 112 across the hall, excuse me. And so that's some of the functional changes that are happening in, you know, so there's some improvements related to House space. There's improvements related to Governor's office space, Supreme Court space. The Attorney General really stays at the same square footage, a little bit less than they currently have. But you can see where, you know, as you went through this and thinking about the next 100 years, you know, and how the building should function, those were changes that working with the tenants that were deemed to be in the best interest moving forward.
Question, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wozlowski, thank you for the overview. Looking at these pictures here, I take it we're replacing marble with marble. And is there any type of a product that's being used to cover over the outside to deal with the problems that we had with the, you know, losing our effectiveness of the
Director.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, that sugaring effect is the terminology they use. They didn't find, and trust me, we have national experts that looked at this same folks that looked at the Washington Monument and the Washington Cathedral after the earthquake, where it's the same team that worked and looked at this building. There really isn't a consolidant that you can apply to marble that's going to enhance the preservation. Matter of fact, the longevity of the stone. They actually think it works in the opposite, that you're trapping in, that stone is a natural stone, and you're trapping in, you're changing the characteristics and the behavior of that stone over time. The technique that they've used, obviously, selective replacement is a last resort. What you'll see in many cases is where they just sanded down and smoothed over where it was sugaring and crystallizing. They sand that down, polish it, and so that water runs off it easier versus being trapped in that sugarene and being able to collect there and to go through a freeze-thaw cycle. As the building goes into its next 100 years, this is just going to be an ongoing cycle of maintenance and care that's required to maintain what is really a very unique aspect of this capital. It has many architectural elements, artwork on the exterior of the capital, and to the extent any of that, when it protrudes out from the building, it's exposed to wind and snow and sleet, and it's done pretty well for its first 100 years, and we're going to extend that out to the greatest extent we can.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Maybe we should put a dome over this place.
Heard worse ideas. Other questions? Very well. Thank you both for coming.
Thank you.
Interesting, good, concise job.
Sure.
So, members, we're not going to be meeting this Thursday. We finished up the reviews, I think, that we should cover. And with this aggressive deadline schedule for policy committees, the fact is that not much has made it to our division yet. But I don't feel we need to meet this coming Thursday. There's a chance we won't meet next Tuesday either. Senator Tomasoni has a large number of bonding requests, and he meets before us, right?
No, he meets Monday, Wednesday.
Oh, Monday and Wednesday. But anyway, we have committee time slots that he can take advantage of and get his stuff done. And, I think that's going to be good, too. So this office will keep you informed on what we're going to be doing. And does anybody have any questions? I would say, though, that before we get out of here this spring, or at least when it gets warmer, that it's a very interesting tour to go up and on the scaffolding and look at how they're taking care of that architecture. And it doesn't take that long either. It can be well organized. So that might be something we might do in this time slot. All right? With that, meeting's adjourned.